I will call this Children and Families Committee meeting to order. Can I get a motion on the minutes from last meeting? Representative Nelson.
Yes, Chair West, I would move the minutes from the previous meeting.
Any discussion to the minutes from the previous meeting? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. We have a full agenda today, so we will get moving on it. So, we'll start with Peggy, Representative Bennett, House File 3489. Thank you for coming, Representative Bennett. I will move House File 3489 to be re-referred to the Education Finance Committee. When you're ready, please introduce your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe there's an amendment, or an author's amendment.
There is. I will move the A5 amendment to House File 3489. Would you like to speak to the amendment?
Just briefly, members, this is some public safety changes from our last committee stop, just aligning definitions with criminal law to what we have in this bill. That's basically what it is.
Is there any discussion to the A5 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the author's A5 amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and the A5 amendment is adopted. Now that the bill is in the shape the author would wish it, please begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for hearing this bill. Really appreciate it. I'm not going to say much of anything because I have two wonderful people here who have been working on this all along with me. But I will add one thing. I'm very passionate about this whole subject of grooming in our schools. It's an issue we see in the news a lot. And for me personally, when I was in high school as a 10th grader, my band director groomed me. And I can still remember to this day very clearly things. It's a life-impacting experience. So, Mr. Chair, if it's okay with you, I'm going to turn it over to my two testifiers. If we would maybe start with Hannah here, and I'll just let them take it over and explain.
Please introduce yourself for the record and be freed with your testimony.
My name is Hannah Lopresto. I'm a victim survivor of grooming and sexual assault by my high school band teacher when I was a student from 2012 to 2016 at Egan High School. Co-chairs West and Katiza Watoon and members, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 3489. As a high schooler, I played percussion and had the same band teacher each year. Early on, this teacher made me feel special by asking me to help him organize music or move instruments after class. Over the course of the 4 years, he slowly began to isolate me from friends and family, normalize touching me and communicating as if we were close friends. On an international band trip to Greece, this escalated to him showing a romantic interest in me, manipulating seating charts so I was always next to him on the airplane, pulling me away from the group on tours, and slipping a secret note in my suitcase. Back at school, he used religion as a form of control, stating that God put me in his life for a reason and made me believe that I had to marry him because of the things I had done. On the morning of my last day of high school, he sexually assaulted me in the band lesson room. He put his hands down the back of my pants and the front of my shirt. I froze and I cried. That same day, he sent me a photograph of a handwritten note saying, "My love for you will always exist. It will last forever." I graduated the next day, and the sexual abuse continued into my early college years. Often when I share that I was groomed and sexually assaulted, most people focus in on the sexual assaults as being the most horrific and impactful. But for me, the 5+ years of grooming were even more harmful to my long-term health and well-being. It was years of psychological manipulation that harmed my understanding of intimate relationships, my own value, and my ability to trust others. Grooming is the creation of a false world made just for you. It lures you in by making you feel special, seen, understood, and then it preys on every vulnerability you have until you're trapped by shame. Shame wants you to hide, and hiding protects your abuser. In the police investigation for my case, there were educators in the school who observed concerning patterns of behavior between this teacher and numerous students and did not report it. The police report documents that one of these educators states that he couldn't stomach the flirtatious behavior, and so he would leave the office at times. I do not believe that these individuals had ill will. I believe that they did not know what grooming was or how to identify the signs, and that better training would have solved this. Required training on grooming as a form of maltreatment better equips our mandated reporters to recognize and stop abuse before it escalates. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Chad Clausen. I'm a detective with the Eagan Police Department. Co-chairs West and Katuza Watun, and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 3489. I'm the detective who investigated Hannah's case. Although there were no criminal charges, that outcome was not due to lack of probable cause. It was due to gaps in Minnesota law in 2016 regarding positions of authority and high school students. Some of those gaps were addressed in 2021, but others remain, many of which are included in this bill. Grooming training for educators. Grooming follows a pattern that includes victim selection, gaining access and isolation, trust development, desensitized physical contact, and post-abuse. Hannah experienced each of these elements. There were opportunities for intervention that did not occur. A clear understanding of grooming, what it is and what it looks like, protects students. Grooming is maltreatment. Grooming is the deliberate, slow process of building a false sense of trust with the child, with the intent of making future sexual abuse easier, regardless of whether sexual violence occurs. During the investigation, I observed a clear playbook used to groom multiple students. The volume and content of communication was alarming, with the repeated phrases, themes, and tactics used to manipulate and control students. Properly defining grooming and adding it to the list of acts of omissions that define maltreatment protects students. Grooming has an end goal of sexual abuse. Waiting for the abuse to occur allows more harm. This bill focuses on early intervention. In closing, a teacher cannot accidentally groom a student. It is not a one-time event. Grooming is a process that can take years. Grooming is not a precursor of maltreatment. Grooming is maltreatment. Hannah endured over 5 years of grooming, a trauma that has deeply impacted her life, and still the perpetrator faced no consequences. This proposal are practical, preventative, they're focused on child safety. They target predatory behavior, not educators. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And with that, we will proceed to a member discussion. Chair Katizawatun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Chair Bennett, thank you for bringing this bill forward. I'm so sorry, Hannah, to hear your story, and I appreciate your bravery and courage coming forward and sharing it so that we can help protect other kids in the future. I think that, you know, we're definitely supportive of moving this in the right direction, and I know that Chair Bennett, you've had some conversations with the department about potential fiscal costs, but we would, you know, support moving it along to education finance and appreciate the conversation today.
Yeah, thank you for coming to share your story. It's not an easy thing to do. Chair Bennett, would you like to close out your bill?
Thank you. Thank you to both chairs, committee members, and a fiscal note has been requested. We're still waiting, but we will deal with those issues. I really hope we can get this through. I want to emphasize that the majority of educators, people working in schools, will not do this kind of thing. They have no intent to. They are there for the betterment of our children and our young people. But there are some bad actors as educators and like any other occupation, and we need to make sure that we have safety guardrails to deal with this. So thank you so much for hearing the bill.
Thank you. All those, I will renew my motion to re-refer House File 3489 to the Committee on Education Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and the bill, as amended, is on its way. We will now move on to a brief presentation from Safe Passage. Thank you for coming today. Please, I would love to spend a lot of time hearing from Safe Passage because they do so much great work, but we are in the legislative session and everything is rushed these days. So if you could keep your presentation brief, but we do value what Safe Passage is, so we are happy to have you. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Committee chairs, members of the committee, thank you for inviting Safe Passage for Children of Minnesota to testify at the hearing today on the findings and recommendations from our most recent Minnesota child abuse fatalities.
If you could lean a little closer to the microphone, please, or pull it closer to yourself.
Sorry.
Thank you.
My name is Maggie Carney. I worked as an RN at Children's Hospitals and Clinics for 40 years. 15 of those years were in the emergency department and 20 years in the child abuse clinic. I am now a board member at Safe Passage, and I'm here to speak about the fatalities report. Safe Passage is devoted to protecting children from abuse and neglect through research, policy, and systems change. Safe Passage now has 10 years of data studying over 200 deaths from maltreatment. This is the third Safe Passage report on child maltreatment fatalities, reviewing cases of children who died between June 1st, 2023 and December 31st, 2024. In this reporting period, we studied 44 child fatalities and 8 were not identifiable by name. The responsibility for keeping children safe is borne by the entire child welfare system, and the children must be the priority. This system can be described as a multidisciplinary team that includes child protective services, law enforcement, the courts, mental health, medical, and legislators. The goal of this report is to identify the deaths due to maltreatment, study case details, identify areas for system improvement, and work to make necessary changes for the safety of Minnesota's children. To identify children, we used a combination of sources to piece together the names and circumstances surrounding each child's death. Essentially, we matched up de-identified state and county reports with the state's death records to identify the names of children. Then we were able to fill in the circumstances surrounding their death by digging through court records, tracking media reports, and various other national databases. It was a very long and time-intensive and inefficient process. The data for child fatalities must be requested by name from the state and or each specific county. This presents difficulty when the names of the children are unknown. Responses to requests for information varied from timely to only after many requests to never. The information provided was sometimes thorough and informative, but usually simple, demographically driven data that made it difficult to identify the children and their causes of death. With that background, I'll now turn to the significant findings of this report. Our first and most significant finding is the continued rise in child maltreatment deaths. Across 19 months, we documented 44 deaths, averaging around 28 children killed per year. This was a substantial increase of 40% from roughly 20 per year in our previous report. The actual number is higher when considering that 4 additional cases were identified after the data analysis was completed. 1 in 5 child deaths studied died from fentanyl toxicity. 28 fatalities, or 63.63%, died due to the neglectful actions of their caretakers. Children 3 and under represented the vast majority of deaths, or 75% of the deaths overall. 50% of the children studied lived in families that received previous reports to child protection. This statistic includes both screened in and screened out reports. Many children had open cases with CPS at the times of their death. Caregiver substance abuse co-occurred with child maltreatment in 40.9% of cases. Substance abuse was a significant contributing factor in additional fatalities, including accidental ingestions and some asphyxiation deaths. The co-occurrence rate of domestic violence was 52.27%. With these findings in mind, we now turn to broad drivers shaping current policies and practices and how they harm children. I'll do this by addressing common misconceptions in the child welfare system. One significant misconception is that neglect is less serious than abuse. Yet Minnesota data demonstrates that 63% of the maltreated fatalities involve neglect. Nationally, the rate is even higher. For surviving children, research demonstrates that chronic neglect can cause severe, lasting developmental damage. Neglect can be more serious and is often more deadly than what we typically think of as abuse. Another misconception is that Child Protective Services removes children because of poverty. State guidance is explicit. When conditions are due solely to poverty, cases do not qualify for removal. Another frequent claim is that removing children is more traumatic than leaving them in unsafe homes. While removal can be traumatic, so is remaining with abusive and chronically neglective caregivers. The research often cited to support this myth usually compares the trauma in children who were in out-of-home placement to the general population of children, many of which have never interfaced with child protection. We also hear concerns that foster care is a worse alternative. However, recent studies show that for infants and young children, foster care is often protective. Several studies cited in our report reflect that foster care experiences are often beneficial for children. Finally, some argue that reporting prenatal substance exposure criminalizes women, but research shows that most women who use substances during their pregnancy enter the child protection system within their infant's first year of life. Avoiding engagement at birth does not protect these families. It misses a critical window for supportive intervention. We believe that several changes in philosophy and practice combined with state-level investments are most likely to result in better outcomes. First, we must reconsider the seriousness of neglect. Current practice often removes children only when they face immediate harm or danger, which leaves many in situations of chronic neglect. Yet a significant portion of Minnesota's child fatalities resulted from neglect. For those children who survive it, the trauma of long-term neglect has lasting developmental and emotional consequences. Neglect must be treated with the same seriousness as other forms of abuse. Second, we must hold parents accountable for their actions. Voluntary terminations of parental rights, often used when involuntary terminations are imminent, do not trigger automatic investigations for future children born to the same parents. Children were also returned to parents who failed to address chronic substance use, leading to ongoing severe neglect, which was fatal. These practices favor protecting parents' rights at the expense of child safety. In turn, infants born with evidence of withdrawal from intoxicating substances should be placed on emergency protective holds until a meaningful, measurable, and enforceable safety plan is in place. The system should consider the totality of circumstances, including the history of all terminations of parental rights, as well as the history of maltreatment, chronic drug abuse, in cases related to screening, removing, placing, or returning children. Third, we must improve our response to domestic violence. State policy currently screens out reports unless there is a direct risk to the child. Despite research showing that witnessing violence between caregivers is emotionally damaging for children, better systems to handle domestic violence are used in other jurisdictions. A systemic policy regarding domestic violence that gives priority to child safety will benefit children by reducing trauma exposure. Fourth, we must end the overuse of family assessment. Although originally intended for only the lowest risk cases, family assessments now represent more than 65% of all child protection responses. Many of the fatality cases studied involved families who had multiple family assessments closed within weeks of opening due to non-cooperation. These uncooperative cases should trigger compulsory investigations with stronger oversight, especially when children under three are involved or chronic safety issues are present. We recommend allowing cases to be assigned to family assessment only once, but never if the alleged child victim is 3 years old or under. Fifth, Minnesota must expand available services by identifying funding streams that are already available yet untapped to support children's services. Making full use of Minnesota's established child advocacy centers, funding the development of new CACs, and mandating functional multidisciplinary cooperation for the sake of efficient case management will lead to better outcomes for kids. This established, accredited, and federally supported system follows the recommendations set forth by the National Children's Alliance, the gold standard for responding to child abuse and neglect. The state must mandate consistent standards for all counties. Minnesota's state-managed, county-administered model for our child welfare system provides minimal statewide structure, leaving local practices to vary widely based on resources and interpretation. The system results are often inconsistent timelines, uneven application of statutes, inconsistent or incomplete documentation, and placements that often prioritize adult preference over the child's well-being. State agencies, courts, and legislature, with input from interested community subject matter experts, must establish clear child-focused standards across the entire child welfare and foster care systems. Lastly, data transparency can influence positive changes for Minnesota children. With consistent, searchable data patterns, trends can be identified and acted upon. Outcomes can be studied and fine-tuned for optimum safety results. Making data available for public study increases systems overviews and opens possibilities for real and meaningful improvements. Data transparency can be the agent for life-saving changes that improve the child welfare system for all of Minnesota's children. In summary, our findings highlight urgent needs for focus on neglect as a concern for causing fatalities, stronger standards for addressing parental drug addiction, real accountability for domestic violence, abuse, neglect, and unsecured firearms, better training for stakeholders, expansion of services for abused and neglected children, consistent standards for responding to cases of maltreatment, and greater transparencies around fatalities. These child deaths reflect systemic issues that can be changed for the better. Positive changes are possible when we all work together. Our shared goal is for every Minnesota child to grow up safe, healthy, and protected. Thank you for the opportunity to share these findings with your committee today. We appreciate your time and interest in our report and the safety for Minnesota's children. It's my understanding that each committee member will receive a full copy of the report. If you don't get one, a report can be downloaded from our website. If you have questions for the organization, we're happy to respond to emails. And we are here especially supporting Representative West's proposed Harvey's Law and Representative Nelson's proposed transparency in child fatality reports.
Thank you for your presentation. Now to member discussion. Tina, thank you for sharing the report with us. And thank you for the work Safe Passage does. I very much appreciate the data-driven presentations that they do and the advocacy for sure. All right, moving onward. We'll move to a bill that was already on the agenda a while back, House File 3819. I will move House File 3819 before the committee to be re-referred as amended to the Judiciary Committee. We already heard this bill, so we will not be taking any additional testimony. This is the bill regarding fraud in the CCAP system and tools to adjust to it. Any member discussion prior to going to a vote? Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question. Excuse me. On line 12.16, Commissioner may request and review recordings or copies of recordings, et cetera, et cetera. My question is, so the recordings, the copies of the recordings, Commissioner requests them. What happens to the recordings after that?
Thank you for that question. It's not prescribed in law. I guess the intention would be that they dispose of them when they are done reviewing them. But if the department has a comment on that, they are welcome to give it. They are. Go ahead and Representative Coulter.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So the reason I bring that up is precisely that ambiguity. And the other reason I bring that up is that under Chapter 13, under the Data Practices Act, it does specify that the Commissioner of Administration is able to release or disseminate data, which I presume this would count as, under another purpose of the law. And so my concern is that now that is data that is in the possession of the department that could theoretically be released or disseminated under some other purpose of the law. So I think that is just something that we are going to, I think it's a frankly kind of a big loophole in the Data Practices Act, but I think it's something that folks need to be aware of with regards to this bill. That's all.
Thank you, Representative Coulter. We would have happily entertained an amendment to that effect, but also it's probably more of a judiciary issue, which is where the bill will be headed. Representative Sensenmura.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I had a question about 10.23. So this is about the record-keeping section, and it says that as a condition of payment, all providers receiving child care assistance payments must submit data on child enrollment and attendance through a statewide electronic attendance and record-keeping system established by the commissioner. So I'm not completely remembering kind of where we're at in that process. I believe that we had allocated some funding to the department to kind of create that system, but I'm not sure where we're at in that process. And wondering if you know or if someone from the department can kind of speak to where we're at in creating that process. Is it feasible, like what is the feasibility of when that would be stood up? And if that is not already in place, you know, what would the cost to the department be? Would there be additional cost to stand that up? Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sensenmura. So the department, when they came before us the last time, they said around June they would roll it out to a select number of providers. They couldn't give us any sort of guidance on how they were going to select them. And then moving forward, they were going to roll it out to the rest of the providers, but couldn't give us any sort of timeline on that. So this gives them basically 6 months of a trial run, assuming they stick to their June schedule. And after that, it should be rolled out. Now, part of that is like we did previously with the SSIS stuff, is if we're not getting something from the department, maybe we need to nudge them to do this. And given the amount of money we dumped on them for this particular thing, I am confident they can do it within the sizable sum we allocated for it. The department may correct me if I'm wrong, though. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Hi, Shana Morse. I'm the Legislative Director covering early childhood at the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. And you do have that correct that we plan to start rolling out in June the electronic record-keeping system. I think the language here is a technical kind of issue in that we can't have the entire thing up and running in June, that there's sort of like a beta testing process that will go underway where we progressively roll this out to providers to make sure that we're able to support them, that the functionality is working the way it's intended to.
Thank you. It's my understanding the effective date for that provision is in January, not June. But either way, something that we can address should we need to. Any other? Chair Katizwa-Tun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And those who are tuning in and members on the committee may remember that we didn't have any time to discuss this bill the last time that it was heard in committee, as well as we were just notified late last evening that this bill was going to be on the agenda for today's meeting. So I think that we have a lot to discuss. We have many bills on the calendar, and I just wanted to point that out, that this was a kind of a surprise that this bill was going to come back up. I'm hoping that you can detail for us on lines 12.21, subdivision 4, license provider requirements. What is the intention for requiring a licensed provider that is subject to video monitoring under this section, that being potential fraud monitoring? What is the point of them having indoor cameras when the original purpose of this bill was to monitor the entrances and exits to determine whether or not there was children actually coming onto the premises?
Thank you, Chair Katizwa-Tun, for that question. And it's nonpartisan, correct me if I'm wrong, but this is not to include those cameras in infant and toddler rooms. As if you look at lines 12.23, it says the subdivisions 3 through 10 that apply to the rooms, citing the requirements of those infant and toddler room cameras that they have listed apply to these cameras as well. I'm pretty sure those are like CCTV requirements and those kind of things. But it's not a requirement to put those cameras in, these proposed cameras in infant and toddler rooms, although that is welcome too. Feel free, centers.
Thank you. I appreciate that clarification. I also wanted to express my concern that the absence of evidence is being considered evidence at lines 12.19. If for some reason Wi-Fi goes down, cameras are damaged, whatever the situation may be, that the commissioner may use that failure to produce recordings of from these cameras as prima facie evidence that the licensed provider cared for zero children during the missing dates and times. I don't think that makes sense. And I think that we should consider rewording that section. I don't think that simply because they aren't able to produce camera evidence that there was children on camera at that point in time, that means that zero children were cared for during that date and time. And then I also wanted to talk about, I'm wondering, previously when we've had the Inspector General here before the committee, we talked a little bit about the unannounced licensing inspections. And here you have added an additional requirement for one additional unannounced licensing inspection. And I'm just curious whether or not that is, if that is to be an actual licensing inspection or if it's intended to be more of a follow-up if there are red flags on the initial licensing inspection that's provided to the IG, and then the program integrity folks would go on site and do an unannounced inspection.
Thank you for that question. That is intended to put more scrutiny on centers that receive many hundreds of thousands of taxpayer dollars to ensure accountability of taxpayer funds. Is there anything else you have prior to a vote?
Yes, I do have a question also about the $500,000 or more annual child care assistance funds, scholarship funds, or the combination of the above. I'm concerned that, you know, if we're taking the steps to monitor centers above that amount, that it may deter fraudsters from, you know, taking or accepting more than $500,000 or more. So, like, if they know that the limit is $500,000, are they just going to say, all right, we can take children up to the point where we earn $475,000 on an annual basis and know that they won't be subject to this restriction?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, my hope is that the fraudsters take less of our money. And with that, I will request a roll call on the bill, and the clerk will take the roll. The chair votes aye.
Co-chair Katiza Watoon?
No.
Vice Chair Hansen?
She's presenting in another committee at this time.
Vice Chair Nelson?
Aye.
Altendorf?
Aye.
Coulter?
No.
Hicks?
She's excused.
Lee?
No.
McDonald?
Aye.
Nadeau?
Aye.
Olson?
Aye.
Perez Vega?
No.
Sensor Mura?
No.
Zalesnikar?
And with seven ayes and five nays, the motion does not prevail and the bill is not referred to the Judiciary Committee as amended. And I will lay over House File 3819. So with that, we'll move to House File 3901, Representative Johnson. I will move House File 3901 before the committee to be re-referred to. To Ways and Means. There is an author's amendment, so I will move the A26 amendment. And if you'd like to briefly cover the A26 amendment, and when we have it in the shape that you would like it, then please introduce your bill.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. It's basically cleaning up some different language inside of it. This is my first time in the committee, so I'm getting used to what different committees are. The other ones just automatically take the amendment and add it. So it's basically changing some language in here, identifying what confidential data is, and outlining different lines and changing. So, sorry.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Is there any discussion to the A26 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like? Seeing none, all in favor of the A26 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. The A26 amendment is adopted. Representative Johnson, please proceed with your bill.
Thank you, Chair, Co-Chair, members of the committee. This is another, I guess, situation of why it's so important that we finally get some modernization in the technology that we have at the state. We have two different departments that are having issues and concerns of what information can be passed on, how do we work together, timeliness and stuff like this. This has to do with the SIS program, I believe, correct?
The Office of the Foster Youth Combat's Permanent Access.
Yes, but the actual program that they're using to access the information is making it very cumbersome. And instead of being able to, one department to be able to access it, it has to go through the Department of Children's to get the information together and get it back to them. There's some disagreement, and we've actually met as late as yesterday to see if we can come up with some kind of a timeline agreement, what can be accessed, what can't be accessed, and that wasn't achieved. So basically, we're moving forward with this this bill to basically give UMFI, I guess, access to the information they need to provide the best service and care to foster families and foster children when they get called in to do some mediation and do some casework. And that's what it really boils down to, is getting that information to them on a timely basis that they can use that going forward. And I have a testifier here.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, co-chairs and members. Again, my name is Misty Coons, and I'm the ombudsperson for Foster Youth. It's nice to see you again. So after nearly 2 years of being in operations, UFI is requesting changes in three areas of our enabling statute. That's retaliation protection, private meetings with foster youth, and records access. And I'll spend my time today discussing the records access pieces. That seems to be the area that there's more difficulty with agreements. The lack of direct access to Social Services Information System, or SSIS, greatly affects our ability to investigate decisions being made about children and youth in foster care. Since July, we have requested data from DCYF for about one case a week, and in that time, delays in receiving information have gotten longer. Some requests, including those related to the decision-making of DCYF, remain unfilled. In one example, it took 2 months to find out whether there were Minnesota foster youth at a facility that had made national news due to concerning allegations. DCYF has stated concerns about the burden of our requests on their staff. Giving us access to SSIS would address this concern and eliminate the time that their staff needs to spend pulling records. DCYF has also stated concerns about data related to information that is protected through attorney-client privilege, which is erroneously entered by caseworkers despite training guiding against this. This barrier to our access can and should be addressed through training of agency workers or through interagency agreements between DCYF with UFI, which we are willing to explore. We've heard concerns about data privacy, which we discussed in a letter provided to you all today and goes into more detail on that. We don't think it's reasonable to use these concerns as a justification to entirely block our direct access to information. And while there are technical concerns about SSIS, we still haven't been able to agree on what UFI should have access to and what should be left up to DCYF to decide. We've received conflicting information about who has access and to what information, and ultimately we're forced to believe that the barriers being presented to us have no workaround. While the plan is for DCYF to grant us case-by-case access in a few years with the modernization process, this does not align with the language that already exists in our statute that grants the UFI the discretion to determine the scope of an investigation. We are not required to disclose information about investigations to get data, and we see this as an issue of transparency. We have worked to find a solution since before we opened in 2024, which includes proposing an interagency agreement to address our concerns. And the reality is that we've not been able to agree on reasonable deadlines for response. And so right now, when our requests go unfilled, there's little recourse for our agency. Ultimately, we hope you can understand the predicament that we're in. We're here to investigate decisions that are being made about children and youth to ensure their health, safety, and welfare. But we are in a position of needing to request data from the agencies whose decision-making we are charged with investigating. As always, thank you for your time, and we're happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Is there any other member of the public here who would like to testify on House File 3901? We have a list. Sorry. Would the Assistant Commissioner George please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony?
Thank you.
These chairs are off.
Chair West and co-chair and committee members. My name is Rebecca St. George. I'm the assistant commissioner for DCYF. So first, I'd like to acknowledge that UFI's concerns about data requests taking too long are valid. For context, we received almost 400 data requests in 2025. We prioritize UFI requests coming from all ombuds offices, but the fact is we are understaffed in the data request area. We're looking into internal solutions that might help make the process more efficient, including we are getting some new software in the next 2 months, I believe, that should improve our timeline. But about the bill. It's really important to note that this is very much a systems issue. SSIS is not set up to allow us to provide broad access to files while also protecting privileged information. If we gave access to all of the data in our systems, we would be out of compliance with both state and federal data privacy laws. We have concerns with the language that would give UFI direct access to any data that they decide is necessary to fulfill their duties. This would allow them to ask for personnel records, confidential investigatory data that lives with OIG, in-process facilities maltreatment investigation data, and anything else they ask for. The current law requires that the new child welfare system, which we're working on, that's being developed, that it provide the ombudsperson for American Indian families and the ombudsperson for foster youth with case-by-case access to non-privileged information that is necessary for the discharge of the ombudsperson's duties, including specific child protection case information while protecting tribal data sovereignty. I point out in 2024, tribal nations made it very clear that they did not want access to be given to their data without request and approval. So thank you for allowing me to testify on this bill on behalf of the agency, and I am open to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else present who would like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, I will close public testimony and move on to member discussion. Well, I guess I have a Chair Katisa Witun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for bringing this issue forward. I know, UFI has been working really hard on behalf of our fosters statewide, and given the presentations and information that this committee has received previously about the status of SSIS, I commiserate alongside you. That's a big part of the reason why we invested $35 million last session into creating a new system that is going to be more workable. I guess I'm hopeful that perhaps the Assistant Commissioner can give us a little bit more information on the process of one of these data requests. Like when the Ombudsperson's Office requests additional data, it's my understanding that the system doesn't allow us to pull anything. You can't pull something and print it. You have to, I don't know. I've been maybe not explaining this well, but it's my understanding you can't run a full report. And so I'm just curious how your department deals with those data requests and kind of what is the process in order to get the information back to the Ombudsperson's Office.
Commissioner St. George.
Thank you, Chairman West. And thank you, Co-Chair. I don't think I can speak with much detail about what it takes to pull the information from SSIS. I can tell you that the requests go through our general counsel's office. We have a data privacy attorney who takes the requests, finds the appropriate people within CSP to get the data that is being looked for, pull the data. I don't actually know what it takes to pull the data, but they then have to redact it, and we don't have any sort of automatic redaction to take care of the privileged information, and then we provide the information. But it's a multi-step process, but also it, as you know, SSIS is, if I could say, a beast. And so it's not a quick or easy process to get that information out.
Chair, could you use me too?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that. So when you say that there's no automatic redaction, what does that entail? And so when somebody is, that you are redacting that private data prior to sending that information back to the ombudsperson's office, how long are these reports typically, and what is the timeline? You said that you're understaffed. What is kind of the typical return time frame, or how long would it take for somebody to go through and redact that by hand? Or is there software that, okay, no.
Commissioner St. George.
Thank you, Chairman West. The timeline depends on the quantity of information being asked for. My understanding is that the requests from UFI in particular have varied from between about 10 pages of information to around 30. And the redaction includes review from our attorneys as well as review from our subject matter experts.
Thank you for that. I have a quick question on violating state and federal law. It might be for nonpartisan, but I assume that UFI employees are also bound by privacy laws and anything else, like any other state government employee. So I can see why it'd be a violation of law to share it with the public or something like that. But within state government, is that also a violation of state law? Are there other cases of that that we are aware of? Ms. Sunderman.
Mr. Chair, members, I think that is a better question for the experts on the Judiciary Committee. But in general, yes, an employee of a state agency such as the Office of Foster Youth Ombudsperson would be bound by state data privacy laws.
Right. Commissioner St. George.
Thank you. The problem is that we're separate departments, and we are the agency that oversees the federal 4E program, where there's certain recommendations that we keep internally. And so UFI is tasked with investigating us, which they do a very good job of doing. But there's a separation there that requires us to keep some information private. There's information that I can't see as the assistant commissioner. There's information that everybody within CSP can't necessarily see. So there's not anybody who's a state employee or even anybody who's a CSP employee gets to see all of the information. There are restrictions within that.
All right. Chair Katisa Watoon, briefly,
please. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess with the mention of the Judiciary Committee, I'm just wondering if we think that this bill should go before the Judiciary Committee as it has some data practices issues.
Chair Katisa Watoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, it's my understanding that it's an automatic referral to Judiciary with the Chapter 13. Okay.
Chief. Yes.
Okay.
So I will amend my motion. So I will go to Representative Johnson to close out his bill before we send it on its way to Judiciary.
Thank you, Chair, Co-Chair, members. As you can see, this is probably a good example of departments trying to figure out how to work with each other and what you can and can't get. But the bottom line is this, you know, I hate to say this because it's become a cliche, it's about the kids, it's about the families. As a elected official, as county commissioner, and we recognize how important and how valuable foster families are as they take in foster youth. And we celebrated it. We even had a dinner. We just had to, you know, bring them in to recognize it. And so for them coming in and then all of a sudden hearing the complications when they have a need and some service, the complications, they shouldn't have to care about the issues that are going on down here and how long it takes because our software is old. This person can't see this one. We need to work better together. And I just don't want to, you know, we shouldn't make them wait for a long period of time, 2 years, 3 years, whenever, to start getting the information they need so they can continue on with what they are concentrating on and what they care about is taking care of the youth. And they are stepping up for that, and we need to make sure we're there for them. I do look forward to, you know, fine-tuning this, seeing how we can make this work in full transparency. Also, on my way in, I received, actually after I got here, I was notified that White Earth Reservation sent in a letter to me saying that they have reservations about it. I look forward as we move forward and do this that we can also, I think you mentioned that with the reservations, with the tribes that they had. I hadn't had a chance to read it, so I don't know what the reservations, they just said they had some concerns. I look forward to working with them and both departments as we try to make this work just like we tried yesterday. Ultimately, we just have to do better. Thank you.
Thank you, Representatives. So I will renew my motion that House File 3901, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary and Civil Law. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way. Thank you, Representative Johnson. We will now move to Representative, Co-Vice Chair Nelson. I will move House File 4408 to be re-referred to the Committee of Ways and Means. I know there's an author's amendment, so I will also move the A1 amendment. Vice Chair Nelson, please introduce your amendment.
Okay, thank you, Chair West, and the so we have the Bill 4408 before the committee and the A1 amendment. What we're doing here is the review team, it's basically making it that you can't retaliate against those that are, whether it's a caseworker or anybody that's involved with doing the reporting, so that it's basically just an anti-retaliation, protecting those that are working on the details of the report.
Any discussion to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Nelson, please introduce your bill.
Okay, so House File 4408. It's a bill I wish I didn't have to bring forward. I think oftentimes we think back to, or I do myself, I think back to childhood and think of the fond memories and the things we used to do as a family and enjoy that, and you think of things that you would maybe do different with your kids, and as you start to see them grow up and have children of their own, you know, there's I've got a couple grandkids now, and you know, it's exciting to see them, but when you, all of us, when we see in the news, we see horrific stories of children that don't get out of their childhood. They've been, whether it's some, you know, something tragic happens at home or in a caregiver. And, you know, oftentimes we wonder why. And, you know, from the news stories, we wonder why, or we may cast, you know, want to know what's happening. But here at the legislature, we're also tasked with setting policy around what happens. What happens in these cases of maltreatment and things like that. And as we craft these policies, I think we need to be able to have measurable things that we can know, so we can have reports and we can know what happened, so we can make it different. You know, it's not gonna unfortunately, we can't change the last outcome, but what can we do different next time? And so this bill is looking at really creating it's a publicly available report that, and right now there is some reports, but there's a little bit of confusion as to whether they should stay in the county, whether they go to DCYF, or, you know, just what is happening, where, you know, what is, you know. And it's a problem when we try to compile this data and see what is happening and where it's going. And in your packets, members, there should be reports from, I think, three other states that are just kind of showing what a couple other states are doing. And we're really trying to be able to have data so we can make a better future for all the children. And with that, Mr. Chair, that is what I intend to do with this bill.
Thank you, Vice Chair Nelson. I'll invite Ms. Kuntz up to the testifier table to testify on this bill. And after that, we'll have Mr. Gehrman. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony. We are going to be on a two-minute timer just to keep things moving along. When you hear the sound, you have 10 seconds left. Go ahead.
Okay, you got it. Hello again. For the record, my name is Misty Kuntz, and I serve as the ombudsperson with UFI. And as you know, we are tasked with the mission of promoting the highest attainable standards of competence, efficiency, and justice for youth who are in the care of the state, our fosters, and we do not take this task lightly. Through this, we review and investigate individual cases and systemic issues, and we make recommendations, including for policy solutions. As an agency, we have investigated the topic being discussed today, the process and reporting of child fatalities and near fatalities in Minnesota. This has included attending trainings led by the Continuous Quality Improvement Team at DCYF, as well as several additional discussions with them, and discussions with local agencies about their review processes. We've also reviewed some policies and example public reports from ombuds offices in other states who are charged with conducting independent reviews of child fatalities and identifying areas of improvement. From this, we've identified some lack of clarity regarding some areas of the process, such as how agency workers and supervisors are to participate in the review. When a fatality or near fatality happens, there is a lot of value in including their perspective because they have the most direct knowledge of a case. They can be uniquely positioned to identify gaps or pain points that led to a critical incident with a child and to inform recommendations for policy and practice improvement. We feel like this bill that's brought to you today is a great step in the right direction. Clearly, the primary intent of our child protection system is to keep children safe. And when a fatality or near fatality has happened, we haven't done that. The transparency and reporting included in this bill helps us as a system better understand where we need to improve while still balancing the need for data privacy and sensitivity with this information. We also want to flag our understanding that fatalities and near fatalities of foster children are not included in the current statute or within this bill. We did pose this question directly to DCYF previously to try and get understanding of this, and they confirmed that because foster homes and facilities fall under a different statute. We feel this needs further attention and action to ensure that critical incidents involving foster children get the same rigorous, multidisciplinary review process and the same transparency in reporting. Thank you again for your time.
Thank you. We will move to Mr. Gehrman, and then we have Ms. Cohen on Zoom. When you hear the lovely sound, that means you have 10 seconds left. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Co-chairs West and Withoon, my name is Rich Gehrman, and I am the founder and former executive director of Safe Passage for Children of Minnesota, and I'm here to speak in support of House File 4408. Safe Passage, as you heard, has produced three reports on Minnesota child fatalities due to maltreatment, covering hundreds of child deaths since 2014, and I performed or supervised the research and writing of each of these reports. And it's based on that experience that I offer some following reasons for supporting this bill. First, it places affirmative responsibility on the State Department of Children, Youth, and Families to post reports related to child maltreatment, fatalities, and near fatalities on the department's website without first requiring the public to request them. And this is going to apply, as Representative Nelson indicated, whether the reports were the product of a joint review at the state level with the panel or of a local review. And this is important because neither the state agencies nor counties have in the past provided this information readily or in a consistent format, despite the statutory requirement for counties to do so. Now, some counties have done well and produced reports to the public when requested, but others have responded only after long delays, sometimes too long to be included in our reports, or produced information at a level that is such at such a summary level that it can't really help us to understand the causes of the fatalities. And for its part, the state agency, despite numerous requests, has not released some of the basic information we've requested, such as even the number of child fatalities in a given year. And I would argue that making this information available is in the spirit and intent of current statutes. So this will clarify their responsibility. And so all of this lack of information and timely information has led to gaps in our understanding of the scope of the problem, as well as factors that contribute to maltreatment-related fatalities. So I also want to say that the requirement
Please,
for the child mortality...
The time limit, if you could just wrap up in a
okay,
sentence or two.
We also support the Child Mortality Review Panel, the annual report, because we think that will also increase public understanding of the issues.
Thank you very much. And now to Zoom, Ms. Cohen.
mute. I'm trying. And then let me, hello, I'm just trying to turn my video on. Okay, there, oh, I did it for a second and then, it, oh, there we go. Okay. Okay. All right, good afternoon. My name is Marie Cohen and I live in Washington, D.C. I've been a policy researcher and a social worker in foster care, and now I write Child Welfare Monitor, a blog that is read by some of the leading policymakers, advocates, and academics in the field. I've also written a report on state policies on disclosure of maltreatment fatalities, and I've also produced my own reports on child fatalities in the District of Columbia based on the very limited data available. So I know a lot about how states can make it hard to get the right information. Child fatalities are the most tragic outcome of a state's failure to protect children from abuse or neglect. The public must have access to timely information about the circumstances leading to these tragedies so that they can identify how the system failed and what changes are needed. For that reason, Congress added language to CAPTA requiring all states to have provisions for disclosing findings and information about child fatalities and near fatalities from maltreatment. Minnesota's current law technically complies with CAPTA, but it's deficient in important ways. Findings and information on fatalities are available only upon request, which means the public will not find out about such deaths unless the media has written about them or relatives have spoken up. The law allows disclosure of previous maltreatment reports, investigations, and agency actions only when they are, quote, pertinent to the maltreatment that led to the child fatality or near fatality. But pertinent is not defined. Under this language, the department could argue that a previous finding of neglect has nothing to do with a child who died of abuse, for example. House file, right, 4408 will be an improvement over current law. I strongly support the requirement that information and findings must be made publicly available on the DCYF website rather than only upon request. However, the bill still needs improvement to achieve the desired transparency. It should be amended to eliminate the language requiring information released to be pertinent to the maltreatment that led to the fatality or near fatality. As I've explained, this language allows the department to radically restrict what information is disclosed. Thank you for the invitation to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Cohen. Is there any other member of the public who would like to testify on House File 4408? And he is just leaving. All right. With that, we will move to member questions. Members. Chair Nelson, to close out your bill. Chair Katiza-Vatoon, sorry.
Okay.
Thank you. Vice Chair Nelson, appreciate you bringing this forward, and I think it's definitely something that we want to consider carefully. Are you aware, or perhaps any of your testifiers aware, whether or not or in how many other states the practice is to just publicly release this information without a request process?
Chair Nelson?
I believe there are three other states that have it publicly available, is my understanding. But then there's a couple other states that have very similar reports like this that are available to request.
Chair, could you speak to me?
Thank you, Mr. Sharon. Thank you for that. That's just helpful.
Actually, can I say something? There are more than three. I would just have to look it up, and I can send it to you unless I can find it in the next couple of minutes. But it's in the report that I wrote that I referenced in my written testimony. Let me try to look. If you have a minute, I can try to look it up while you're asking other questions.
We probably don't have a minute, but please send that report to the members.
Okay, we'll do. It's quite. I think it's at least 10 states that do that. There are a whole bunch of states that have it on their websites. Yeah. So.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Katiza-Vatoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that will be helpful for reference going forward. My next question is for the circumstances in which there is a near fatality. Would there be any reason to consider the victim survivor's wishes in circumstances around their personal experience, whether or not they want that information to be made public?
Chair Nelson, Vice Chair.
Thank you for the question, Chair Katiza-Vatoon. And I definitely would respect those wishes. And I don't know if that is, I don't think that is outlined in here. I don't know how it is currently handled. on a near fatality. I don't know what the, you know, investigations, what they look like, how those are handled, but I think at that point, I think really to the point of the report would really, I think we probably need to focus mostly on the fatalities measured, but at the same time, I think, you know, in an instant of like a, I think there's things that we can learn from a near fatality, but I'm not sure if that's how crucial it is. I don't know if, and I think one of my testifiers can speak to it.
Go ahead, Ms. Coons.
Thank you. My understanding is that even with the changes with this bill of increasing transparency, it's still protecting identities of children in fatality who have passed away or have had a near fatality experience. And I think that's critical because of the sensitivity, whether it's a child who's passed away or a near fatality for them and for their, you know, their surviving family members and siblings and things like that. So hopefully that clarifies what you're getting at.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then finally, the department was in the room, and I'm just curious. So in lines 2.24 through 2.29, we're obviously removing the section about denials, because if we're saying that this information is public, you know, that there wouldn't be denials of information. But I'm just curious, and perhaps the testifiers that are up there are able to speak to it, What sort of process does the department go through in determining whether or not they were going to deny somebody's request?
Mr. Guerin.
Chair Withoon, essentially these reports are only available currently from the county. So our experience has been that when you ask for a report and the county doesn't respond, you really don't have much recourse, you know, having staff and legal support to go and push on that is not very easy. When the Star Tribune did their major reviews of this twice in the last 10 years, they had staff lawyers, and so they were better able to get that information. So this would just take that out of the picture.
All right, last one, Chair Cortese with you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my request would potentially be that we lay this bill over so we can continue talking about it within the jurisdiction of this committee. I know that there's a fiscal note pending, but if not, are we going to re-refer this to Judiciary as well, given the reference to Chapter 13?
Nonpartisan, is there a reference to Chapter 13 in here? Because that's a mandatory referral, I believe. Ms. Senderman.
Mr. Chair, members, there are references to Chapter 13, but it does not amend anything in Chapter 13.
Okay. So it would be the preference of the committee to send it to Ways and Means, where we both sit, so it won't escape.
Correct.
Done?
That's fine.
All right. Thank you. Vice Chair Nelson, please wrap up your bill.
Thank you for that. And as we look at this, you know, making a difference in the future is something that we need to look at the past to be able to change. And, you know, we saw too often we see things that we should have learned from. And what I'm really wanting to be able to do with this is be able to take and get measurable, actionable items. And it's not a bill to be able to poke fingers and saying, well, you were wrong, or, you know, the parents were wrong, or wherever that is, or a caseworker, but that out of this that we can have different outcomes for going forward for the future. So with that, I would move to re-refer this bill to the Ways and Means.
All those in favor of referring House File 4408 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way to Ways and Means. Next, we have Representative Olson with House File 4316. I will move House File 4316 to be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. There's an author's amendment, the A1, to insert what was, I believe, intended to be in the original bill. But Representative Nelson, please proceed. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, the A1 amendment was inadvertently disconnected from this bill, and what it would do is just require some extra notification for where it requires DCYF to note that violations were self-reported. So this whole bill is about maltreatment and further transparency into maltreatment incidents in child care centers. So this would require DCYF to note that the violations were self-reported, which can assist them saying, hey, we're policing up ourselves, helps their look. It does things like require centers to have a poster in the public area on how to recognize signs of child abuse, as well as in the introduction packets that children's families have to fill out, would provide that information as well. Here's what signs of abuse look like. So that's what the amendment would do in a nutshell, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Olson. Any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the amendment to get in the shape the author wishes, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. The bill is in the shape the author would wish it. I'd like to invite up Dr. Harper as our first testifier, followed by... Did I say prevail? Oh, yes. Okay. Relevant. The amendment prevailed, to be clear. Go ahead, Dr. Harper. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony. You will hear a sound when it's a minute 50 and you have 10 seconds left.
Thank you, chairs and members of the committee. I'm here to speak and support the bill. My name is Dr. Nancy Harper. I'm a physician and professor of pediatrics at the University of Minnesota. I practice as a child abuse pediatrician at the Center for Safe and Healthy Children. I have participated in and published research on child physical abuse injuries. Healing is a matter of time, but also a matter of opportunity. This less-known quote is by Hippocrates, and it applies perfectly to child health. Young children depend on adults in the world to protect them and help them when in harm's way. The majority of children injured by physical abuse are younger than four years of age, with infants under one at substantial risk. Bruising is the most visible and common sign of physical abuse, but not all bruising is equal. When we see children in the hospital with serious injuries from physical abuse, we often hear that the child had prior bruising. Bruising on body parts that is concerning to a trained eye, but is sadly not recognized as a red flag by the caregivers in that child's life. We expect active toddlers and preschool-aged children to get minor skin injuries and bruises on bony areas like their knees and their shins. But did you know that a bruise found on an infant is considered a sentinel injury? That is an injury that is highly correlated with abuse and a predictor of future, more severe injury if the care environment is not mitigated. To help us understand which bruises are concerning for child physical abuse, experts at Ann and Robert H. Lurie Children's Hospital of Chicago designed a bruising rule for children under 4 years of age. This rule has a helpful acronym called 10-4-FACES-P. The acronym allows us to recognize the areas where bruises are a concern for physical abuse. The bruising rule states that any bruise on an infant 4 months of age and younger is concerning for physical abuse, as well as bruising to the following areas. 10 stands for torso, which is chest, back, stomach, your area around where your underwear or bathing suit would cover, ear and neck. Faces stands for frenulum, which is the little pieces of tissue between your lip and your gums and under your tongue, angle of the jaw, the fleshy part of our cheek, our eyelids, and subconjunctivae, which is the white part of your eye. And the bruise would be a red sort of appearing hemorrhage in that white part of your eye. And the P stands for patterned bruising. Thankfully, this acronym is easy to teach and a poster can be printed and displayed. The bruising rule is not meant to diagnose abuse, but help others recognize these injuries in young children and take action to get help before it is too late. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Harper. And it is in your packets,
yes.
Members, so please review that. Next on the list, next on the list is Ms. Winkler, and then after that is Ms. McNally. And then once we finish public testimony, we'll go to member questions.
Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony. When you hear the sound, you have 10 seconds left. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Hannah Winkler. Despite my last name, this is my first time testifying. I am a mother of two children, a former child care provider, and I currently work in children's mental health. I work with children who've experienced trauma and abuse. I'm here today in support of requiring child care centers to post information for caregivers about the warning signs of abuse. Our goal was simple with this poster, to make critical safety information accessible for all. This poster is a simple tool to help caregivers recognize the signs of abuse. It normalizes awareness and ensures that all families have access to the same information. A clear and visible poster brings attention to this issue without requiring additional training or significant cost. This information is especially important in child care settings because children at this age are amongst the most vulnerable. They cannot advocate for themselves, so they rely on adults to advocate for them. Many people are not aware of the signs of abuse, so this poster would be helpful for caregivers to learn the signs of abuse. And when parents drop their children off at child care centers, they are placing enormous trust in these environments. Most child care providers work very hard to keep children safe, but the reality is that abuse and neglect can happen in any environment where there are children. The earlier that we can recognize warning signs, the sooner a child can be protected. Thank you all.
Thank you for your testimony. Now, Ms. McNally, please step up, introduce yourself for the record, and proceed with your testimony.
Chair and members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Crystal McNally, and I'm the founder of the nonprofit organization called Never Shake Minnesota. We work with victims and survivors of abusive head trauma, also known as shaken baby syndrome. I am also the mother of Nolan McNally, an abusive head trauma survivor. On September 14th, 2017, just a few hours after I dropped Nolan off at his in-home daycare, I received a call that every parent fears the most. Nolan wasn't waking up. He was only 6 months old when he was severely abused by his daycare provider. Nolan suffered life-threatening injuries, including a traumatic brain injury, bleeding on his brain, a skull fracture, a sternum fracture, bleeding behind his eyes, and bruising on his legs. This tragedy not only changed Nolan's future, but also the lives of so many others who love him, including mine. I'm here today because I believe every parent and caregiver should be educated about one of the earliest possible signs of abuse, bruising. It was not until after Nolan's traumatic injuries that I learned more about what bruising can mean. In fact, we found out that another infant in the in-home daycare also had bruising on her right forearm about a month before Nolan's injuries, a big red flag. Abuse is difficult to talk about. It can feel taboo, but knowledge is power. Understanding what bruising is normal during a child's development and what bruising is not is information that we're lacking in this state. Daycare workers who are mandated reporters should be educated about bruising so that they can help keep children safe. Parents and caregivers deserve access to this knowledge as well, and that's why I support this bill. I don't know whether Nolan had bruises before his serious abuse he suffered, because at that time, I didn't know what warning signs to look for. This poster will help take one more step toward protecting children, and it may even help prevent future abuse. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing that and coming before the committee again. Ms. Dannon. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Excuse me. Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Darielle Dannon, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Child Care Association. Thanks for having us. I actually want to start with sort of the conversation folks have just been having about posters recognizing physical abuse. And I want to flag that we do, so we're very supportive of this. However, we do have concerns that there's only child care centers within the bill that are required to put this poster up. And there are multiple other settings that children are in care, including family child care settings. And I know that in family child care, folks are required to post their licensure So we would really strongly encourage members to also have this requirement in that setting as well. I do want to speak real quickly about maltreatment notifications, sort of the other parts of the bill. So speaking about, we think that more information on potential employers would be helpful. And yes, providers are likely to know more about potential hires and make more educated decisions. We like the concept and the direction. However, this could make things difficult for individuals in a low-pay industry. So an example from a board member is one teacher alone with six kids. She's helping a kid while another one used scissors to cut the hair of a child. That was found as maltreatment. And so the question would be, is this on your background study? Basically, we don't want people to be giving people a life sentence for their career if the state determines something was not intentional or truly harmful that was maltreatment. In short, I think we like the direction of more information on background studies and think this deserves attention in comparison to what other states provide and that we could learn from. Iowa, for example, does something like this, and it's helpful, and I would take a look at what they're doing. Additionally, I want to speak real quickly about investigation involving maltreatment against a facility. So Minnesota already has a two-pronged maltreatment system, one for individuals, another for the program as a whole. We do have multiple directors who oversee multiple centers. This would require folks to have to be named, and is actually a little bit like holding the CEO of McDonald's personally accountable if employees at one restaurant didn't follow their training and customers got sick. So we would flag for you that other states are looking to mirror how Minnesota does our system versus this change. And then I think lastly, notification of the end of investigation. We don't have any issues with notifying all families enrolled in a program about founded maltreatment against an individual or the program. Transparency about actual complete investigations is important, both what they emailed and what the provider's response. I think in closing, we're very supportive of, you know, obviously the posters. Again, would encourage that to encompass a little bit broader spectrum, and very supportive of sort of working on and ending maltreatment. We do have these flags about the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dannon. Thank you for catching that. We did, I know this language went out, but then there was more language added later, and that did not get up, because I do the language, the concern you brought up about the centers, not including family child care on the posting, like that's, that is a very big concern. So we are actually going to lay this bill over so we can get that fixed next week, and we're going to move on to the next item on the agenda. We will have a small discussion next week. I know, Representative Coulter, you did have something, but.
Yeah, just quickly, Mr. Chair, it's kind of a moot point since we're laying the bill over anyway, but I notice on line 4.25 of the A1 amendment, it does direct the commissioner consult with to develop these materials in consultation with the commissioner of health. I believe that might mean that it would then have to go to the health committee, but I am not an expert.
Thank you, Representative Coulter. We are going to lay it over so we can get an answer from nonpartisan or something. In the meantime, Representative Sensenmura, if it can wait, great. If it can't, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Olson, for bringing this bill. I think it's really important. I know, Chair West, you and I spoke last year about some of the background studies and trying to figure out how to improve that system specifically as it came to, you know, employees that were doing things on the dark web, and I think that we should still look into that. But I think this is really important, I guess, and maybe we just need to put it to next time. But, you know, based on the comments from Ms. Dannon, I'm just wondering about the maltreatment, you know, so I think the example that was given was like a kid cutting some hair, right, which that's like a little surprising to me that would be maltreatment, and maybe that goes into a kind of a separate conversation about what is being classified as maltreatment and not. But my question is, under your bill, if you are getting something back from the background study that says this person's not disqualified, but they do have an instance of maltreatment, are you getting any details about what that instance is to be able to then make a decision that says, oh, actually, that was just cutting a kid's hair, I'm not that worried about it, versus, oh, that was bruising, I am worried about that? Thank you.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a wonderful clarifying question that, you know, bringing up this idea, I think we can all agree that we don't want to provide these licensed individuals with a life sentence, as the testifier stated. But if, in fact, they are serious cases of maltreatment, we want them to receive a life sentence. So that's some really great stuff. We're laying the bill over, and by the time we get back to this next week, we'll have a great, great clarification for you. And I think we'll have a really spectacular bill that we can pass out of this committee. Thank you.
Thank you. So the bill is laid over. Sorry about that oversight on our part. Now, moving on to House File 4277. We heard this last week. We had lots of testimony, and then we had 15 minutes of discussion, in which there was not a ton, but we do have some amendments. And which amendment? Well, I will move House File 4277 before our committee to be referred to the Committee on Judiciary and Civil Law. Is it amended? Okay. And we'll go with the DE1. Representative.
Oh, sorry. We do DE2 first.
Okay. The DE2. Representative Hanson. Sorry.
Thank you, Chair. Just wanted to wait to be recognized. Yeah. The DE2 amendment is a new idea. As most folks know, I've brought forward a bill to an amendment about the task force, which wasn't loved. And so I had made a commitment that I would try to find another path forward that would be palatable and doable and feasible and viable. And this was one of the things that we wanted to discuss. And so this is a pilot program that would have the commissioner establish a video security camera pilot program to assess the effect of video security cameras on the health and safety of children under the care of a child care program. I won't go into too much given the time, but just wanted to highlight that. There is a blank appropriation here, so obviously it would be contingent on whatever funds we can find, but I wanted to at least put this forward as an alternative option to the task force. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hanson. Really appreciate the brevity as well. That's very much appreciated. I would oppose, you know, anything that deletes the whole bill without having a requirement. One, I see the pilot program as a much more appealing option than the task force, but anything that costs the department money, you know, since it requires them to install the cameras, is my understanding, that, you know, has no chance ever in this present legislature we find us in the budgetary situation. But any closing comments, Representative Hanson, on your amendment? Chair Katsuzu with you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think, I mean, just based on your comments and concerns about the cost to the department in this potential amendment, I think, you know, we need to weigh very carefully the fact that we are willing to offset that cost by costing a lot of money to our small businesses and child care centers across the state if we do not help to cover that. So I just, we see that it's a large cost in order to run a pilot program. That means it's also going to be a large cost to the child care centers. So I just wanted to point that out.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Chair. Well, it's unfortunate, and this is actually a data-informed model and evidence-based practice that I wanted to put forward. This is modeled off of the pilot program that is happening in Australia right now, where they have invested $183 million to support their child care program and families. And so I would ask folks to vote for this, again, if we're going to follow the data, as we've heard from a number of different folks who prioritize their work on child safety and the effective policies that make a difference, that actually have tangible results. I think this is one of the data-informed measures that we could pursue. So I would ask for your support.
So without further ado, the Representative Hanson moves the DE2 amendment. We'll go to a vote. All members in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No.
No.
The motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. Now we'll go to the A6, which is Representative Coulter, the A6 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd like to request a roll call.
a roll call has been requested. There will be a roll call. Chair Cole.
Thank you.
Representative Cole.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This amendment does, the vast majority of it is just conforming language. But what this amendment would do is apply this bill to all child care centers, all family or group child care providers, and all license-exempt child care centers. I think it is, for myself, kind of concerning that the bill as it stands right now only applies to centers that take public dollars, when we know that if the purpose is indeed to protect children, as we heard even from testifiers last week, that this kind of abuse can occur in any kind of setting. And so I think if that is the purpose of the bill, then we should apply it to all centers. And so that is the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Coulter. That is indeed the purpose of the bill. And honestly, I wouldn't be drastically opposed to expanding it to all family child care. That's my personal opinion. One of the biggest distinctions between family child care and centers is centers fire their employee and move on. It's not like their fault that that's the way the system works, but it is what we see when a family child care provider is involved in something horrible, like something either went horribly wrong or something horribly was done. Their system is done, gone. We do not see that same level of accountability in the centers. And then in addition to that, one concern that's been brought up repeatedly is people want an option that's beyond, like they don't necessarily want all their children to be monitored. So in the spirit of allowing an option for the people who feel that way, that's another reason why there is, does not extend to family child care. So I would urge members not to support the amendment. Chair Katiza Batun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess just to follow up on Representative Coulter's concern that, you know, as you've brought forward this bill, the idea is not necessarily to only provide evidence in the case that something happens, but the idea that somehow cameras are going to keep our children safer. So if the idea is that cameras are going to help keep children safer and that there is going to be some level of prevention, which there is no data to show, then I think that we should move forward with this amendment because every child, no matter where they are cared for, should be safe. So I would ask members for a yes vote.
Representative Coulter.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Chair Katiza Batun said it well, that if the purpose here, again, is to protect all kids, you know, again, we heard from testifiers last week that physical abuse can and does happen in family child care centers. And, there are better ways to get at options if that's what we're thinking about. I don't think it's good policy if this is what we're moving on to only target centers, and in particular only target centers who take the neediest kids.
The clerk will take the roll.
Katiza Watoon.
Aye.
West?
Aye.
Hansen?
Aye.
Nelson? Nelson?
No.
Altendorf?
No.
Coulter?
Aye.
Hicks? Lee?
Aye.
McDonald?
Nay.
Nadeau?
No.
Olson?
No.
Perez Vega?
Yes.
Spencer Mura?
Yes.
Zalesnikar?
The chair votes no. No, that's my fault, not your fault. There are 6 ayes and 7 noes. The amendment does not prevail. The A3 amendment, Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was hoping we got you on that last one. I'm glad, actually, Mr. Chair, that you referenced options, because that segues very nicely into the A3 amendment, which in essence creates an opt-out for parents who do not want to have their kids recorded. What the amendment does is it requires the centers to notify all parents. And this is at the time of enrollment, and obtain written consent from parents. And then it goes on to say that if a majority of parents and legal guardians of the children do not provide written consent, that the center must not install new or use installed video cameras. And then it provides a process for, I believe, is it every year? Yes, every year. Wanted to make sure I was seeing it correctly. Every year for providers to review that and see if they qualify for this, would be required to have cameras under this bill or not.
Representative Coulter, I actually like the idea about if a majority of family members, families object that they do, that the center is not required to comply. Would you take an oral amendment isolating just that piece? Talk to, it is readily prepared if you'd like to hear it. If you'd entertain it, if that makes no difference, we can just vote the amendment down. Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry to clarify, when you say that piece, can you tell me which lines in particular?
Ms. Day.
Chair, members, the oral amendment would delete Section 3, so lines 1.3 to 1.15, and amend Section 4.
Oh, Chair Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the concern that I have about that is now, it would delete Section 3. So would not, I want to make sure I'm understanding this. So it would not require the center to obtain written consent, but then it would, but then if parents, I'm not sure how that would work exactly. If parents don't submit the written consent that they're not being asked for.
Currently, they're required to be, under current law, they're required to be informed, like in written form, so they are going to be aware, and if they object, they would object when they are informed, is the idea. Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, I think I understand. The concern I have is then now, in essence, we are putting the burden on the parents, because now the center is not being required to obtain that written consent. And so it falls then to the parents to proactive, would fall to the parents to proactively indicate their lack of consent. I don't feel strongly either way. My preference would be I'm a little surprised here. I'm kind of thinking on the fly here. I do think the center should have to obtain that consent. I do think they should notify parents. That to me feels like a pretty integral piece of the bill. And I guess I would just prefer that we not require parents to go out of their way and submit this written consent, let alone, I don't know how. So if the center doesn't have to obtain the written consent, how they would go about then determining that process on the yearly basis. So respectfully, I think I would prefer to leave the amendment as is.
All right. Did you request a roll call? All those in favor?
Mr. Chair.
Representative McDonald.
Sorry, yeah, I have a comment. I'm not sure what Representative Coulter just said in the last 4 minutes, but I do tend to support this amendment as a photographer. When I photograph commercial photography, especially children, it is required to have model releases for students. So I think this probably would be a prudent to amendment to support in that respect, to get the parents received. In dealing with children's photography, especially commercial work, there are some that are, for religious reasons, are not, we are not allowed to photograph. So this wouldn't be a pretty good safeguard. Just consider, Mr. Chair.
Representative McDonald, what this amendment does is if one parent objects, then it wouldn't matter if the majority, because one parent declines,
So then there would be no cameras in the facility. Which you, there is software that selectively blurs out faces, but there is no way to like delete an entire person from the recording. Chair Katiza Batun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to clarify what this amendment actually does. So in line 1.18, it says, if a majority of parents and legal guardians of children enrolled in the licensed child care center do not provide written consent, then the center would be exempt. So it's a majority of the parents or guardians of the children currently enrolled in the center, not just a single parent or guardian.
Ms. Dake, could you please clarify? So the misunderstanding or understanding here, if under the amendment with no amendment, if a single parent does not consent, does that prevent cameras from going in, or does that just factor into the other part where it requires a majority to object?
Chair members, as written, I don't think the amendment speaks to what to do in the situation that you've described, where if one or two opt out, whether the center can continue to use the cameras.
That, yeah, and that is where my, like, if it was, I'm not opposed to the consent for the same reasons that are written, just a single person preventing. I'm all for the majority of parents who would not, who would object to it, but not just one. Representative Coulter.
Well, Mr. I guess, I mean, that's the way I read the language. It says, if a majority of parents and legal guardians of children enrolled in the licensed center do not provide written consent, the center is exempt from this section and must not install. It doesn't say if any parent of any children enrolled. It says if a majority of parents and legal guardians enrolled. That to me seems pretty clear.
Representative Doe.
Thank you. And I think there's two things going on. So the first part is if legal guardians don't consent, then there's a non-consent that they're providing. But if the majority, you know, so it, you've got individual parents that say, I don't consent to have my children photographed, but the majority says it's okay. The problem exists with those parents that don't provide consent. So that's where the majority has decided that they can do it, but Section 3 of your bill, of your amendment, basically provides them to not consent, and then it creates a problem with the photography. So there's just a conflict between Section 3 and Section 4.
And not opposed to the majority mindset, but Representative Sensenmura.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So right now, under current law, is there any opt-out for families?
Under current law, there is no opt-out because it only applies to a center with a maltreatment violation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I'm a parent at a center of a maltreatment violation and I get notified that my center will be installing cameras, what would happen if I said I want to opt out and not have my student videotaped?
If you preferred to not have your child monitored at a center with a maltreatment violation, you could go to another center.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I guess I would argue that the same would apply here, that if, to Representative Nadeau's point, if a parent does not want their, So the right to decline in this case is decided by the majority of parents. And if that majority decides that they do not want to decline, that they do not want to opt out of this requirement, then the parents who do not want their children recorded, the option afforded to them would be to go to another center.
I'm fine with if that's how it works. That's the intent of the committee. We can find this is going to judiciary where this can be further litigated, but I would say we can accept the A3 on that amendment, and they're experts on consent over in judiciary, so I think we can clear up what happens
in another case. So all those in favor of the A3 amendment, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The A3 amendment is adopted. Now, the A8, Representative Lee.
Thank you, Chair. This one's pretty straightforward, creating a database and then also requiring work references for staffers. I think this is important because because it brings a light and emphasis to the actual workers themselves. Would ask for members' support to add this amendment to be able to make sure that we have a paper trail. I think one of the situations that can come up is if a worker, decides not to, for some reason, put a previous employer on their resume, then this database is there as a safeguard for licensees and the department to be able to double check and then just be able to say, hey, let me follow up with the references and have that conversation to be able to do our due diligence. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lee. I think that is a good idea and would urge members' support. All those in favor of the A8 amendment, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The amendment prevails, and the motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. See, hey, we can work together. We are going to take a vote in 7 minutes, so please be quickly. Representative Censor Murrah, the A2 amendment. Thank you very much. The A6? A7, yeah. The A7 amendment, right? Okay. All right, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So one of the things that I think is really important to talk about when we are talking about cameras with young children is the ability for that footage to be exploited. I really appreciate Vice Chair Hansen's leadership on this, and I think that we, as a committee that cares about the safety of children, can hold both the physical safety, making sure that children are not physically abused, and making sure that children are not victims of sexual exploitation through video or video manipulation. So one of the concerns that I have is wanting to make sure that child care facilities are able to purchase able to purchase the kinds of video equipment that would have the security that is and safety that is needed to ensure that people are not able to access this footage. So when we were in committee last week, I think it was talked about, that it could be as low as $50 a month. I know that in some of the research that I have done to get safe and secure kind of footage and have it installed and have a system, it would be much more than that. So this would appropriate funding to DCYF for video security cameras and recording and the retention and disposal. There are about 7,800 child care facilities in Minnesota, and so this could be about 10,000 per facility to support with the installing and implementation of these video systems. So this would appropriate $78 million to DCYF to ensure that if we are going to do this, we're doing it the right way, and that this is not going to put our childcare businesses that are already on the brink out of business. Thank you. I'm encouraging a yes vote.
Thank you, Representative Murrah. Well, the amount, if you count 8,000 businesses, does create a significant expense. Individually, it is a modest one-time expense with a very modest recurring cost, which we do have a technology fund that they can apply to that we allocated money to last year, and then a numerous other development grants and other things that child care centers can avail them of to offset the costs. So I'd urge members not to support this amendment. Chair Katiz Batum.
Mr. Chair, I would request a roll call.
Roll call being requested. There will be a roll call. The clerk will take the roll.
Okay. Katiza Watoon?
Aye.
West?
No.
Hansen?
Aye.
Nelson?
No.
Altendorf?
No.
Coulter?
Aye.
Hicks? Lee?
Aye.
McDonald?
No.
Nadeau?
No.
Olson?
No.
Perez Vega?
Yes.
Censor Murrah?
Yes.
Zelaznikar.
There being six ayes and seven nays, the amendment does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. Chair Katiba Toomey, A9.
Mr. Chair, thank you. The A9 amendment members would postpone the implementation of this program from 2027 to 2029. And that, I believe, would give us additional time to consider any additional changes or requirements that we want to make regarding the safety and security of the video cameras. As well, it would allow childcare programs additional time in order to do the correct installation. So it is a delay in implementation, and I would ask for member support. I apologize. It does additionally move from child care centers to all child care facilities. So again, it would qualify for family child care elsewhere, but it would allow them additional time to install before the program would go into effect.
Thank you, Chair Katiza-Watoon, for your amendment. For the same reasons on the expansion to all child care, same as last time that came up. The other aspects I would consider in a future committee. But we can address that in judiciary, particularly the delayed enactment. If that is what is needed to move this bill down the field, I find a delay enactment to be appropriate. But unfortunately, we do not have the time. So I would urge members not to support the amendment. But if that does make a difference in its passage, it's something I would consider in the judiciary committee where the bill is headed. All right, so we'll take a vote on the A9 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No.
No.
The motion does not prevail, and the amendment is not adopted. With that, we do have the DE1. Is the DE1 being offered? Thank you very much. So with that, this is a very important bill. We need to pass Harvey's Law. Appreciate the members' discussion, and we're happy to work together to get things done. And I would urge members to support the bill. Chair Katiza-Watoon.
Final comments to the bill, Mr. Chair. I believe Vice Chair Hansen would like to talk, and then myself.
Vice Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. You know, this committee's been tasked with the responsibility to really build a better and safer Minnesota for all of our children and families across the state. And I know that I take that responsibility really seriously, as do most folks here. And we want to tackle these issues like the one before us and do so seriously. And I do that with any other bill or issue that has been ahead of us. And that's both because of my own personal experience and the experiences of folks that I represent in my community. And so I'm really grateful to all the parents who have come forward and testified, because we know that being vulnerable like that and sharing is really hard, but it matters a whole lot. And the courage to advocate as a means to channel that pain into change so that fewer people have to experience what they have, I think is really important and meaningful and deserves to be recognized as many times as possible. And I know that all of us are committed to that mission. We all agree that kids deserve to be protected. They deserve to be safe at childcare, at school, and everywhere they are, because really no parent should have to worry about their child being harmed or killed somewhere that they're supposed to be safe. That's the brass tacks of it. I'm also feeling really sad today, because the hard part about all of this is that we have the same goal, but we don't agree that a one-paragraph bill is the way to get there. No other state has passed a mandate like this, and a one-paragraph bill that doesn't address the very valid concerns that we've heard about opening up our child care centers to hackers, abusers, potential closure, that means it's just simply not ready to become law. And I was really hoping today that I would get here and I would see posted earlier today to see an amendment from you, Chair, that addressed the concerns that we heard and that even the amendments we've offered to make sure that we're not leaving out 31,000 kids that go to family child care or any center that doesn't take the forms of payment that are referenced. Wasn't even proposed. And this conversation's been going on for over a year. And Representative West, you know the concerns. You were provided lots of feedback about cybersecurity, and multiple experts offered to help. And given your commitments last year and then again last week, I was feeling really hopeful that you would bring forward a bill today that would address and incorporate those concerns and recommendations that came from a number of different folks. And so I'm really disappointed. And it's really, like, honestly, absolutely breaks my heart because of what is happening in these conversations and in folks that are trying to heal. Because without these changes, I know I can't support the bill without these changes, without applying it to everywhere, without making sure all kids get that protection, without making sure that we are having those cybersecurity measures taken into consideration when they were right there. We brought forward a lot of other amendments, and that was one that I thought you were leading on. So it really breaks my heart that I'll have to vote no on this today, because a one-paragraph bill that has the implications that reach so far beyond what the bill claims to do isn't ready. And I think we have a really huge and heavy responsibility to not cut corners on our work here, especially when it comes to the safety of children. I've offered to keep doing this work, you know, to make this approach stronger. I've offered several different, you know, ideas to embed effective protections and prevent unintended harm and consequences, and to truly follow the data towards evidence-based approaches that protect our kids. I've spent my career here in the legislature working on these efforts because of the experiences I had in my life and that I want to protect any child from ever having to go through again. And I'm renewing my offer to continue doing that, because I want to continue partnering. I want to continue working together. And I am, again, deeply saddened that this is the issue that our great relationship has diverged on. And I really was looking forward to making sure we could get to a place where we could leave with something. So I just want you to know, Chair West, that I'm really sad about that. And I think we had what it took to work together. And I hope that there's some semblance of hope left for that. Thank you.
Chair Katusiwatun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. members, I'm grateful for a mostly full and thorough discussion of the proposal and amendments today. We did pare down our amendment requests, and that's, you know, in big part because we as DFLers share the commitment and the goal of keeping every child safe. But I think that today's discussion showed that this is very much the tip of the iceberg. This is an emotional topic. I hope the families who have come to share their stories and all those whose stories we haven't heard know that we value and respect their advocacy. Thank you for being here as we continue this important conversation from last session. Losing a loved one is traumatic, and it's understandable to desire urgent action, but in the legislature, things don't always move at the pace that we prefer. It took over a decade to pass paid family leave, and there are still those working to roll that back. As we consider what would be first in the nation mandate, we can't rush this process. The maltreatment surveillance mandate that we passed last year has not yet gone into effect. And Chair West has shared his desire to work on a compromise bill, but DFL members were not included in the drafting process of this proposal and have not been consulted after expressing concern on the expansion, expense, and the real potential of exploitation of this camera footage. Chair West and I do share a commitment to both civility and good governance, but passing bills out of this committee and any committee this year require reaching across the aisle to find a workable solution, and this proposal is not there yet. To ensure that this bill does not cause additional harm to our Minnesotans, more consideration is necessary to avoid real consequences. We can't ignore things like potential sexual exploitation and the impacts that this unfunded mandate will have on small businesses statewide. As members, we are not experts on data privacy or childcare, and additional time is needed to consider all the perspectives as we work to improve oversight, training, and outcomes in our early care and learning systems.
And given this, I must recommend a no vote to my members today, but I do hope to continue to work together to find ways to keep kids safe without opening them up to future abuses. I feel that's the responsibility of us on this committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I request a roll call.
There will be a roll call. I'll keep my comments brief. We're already over. This is incredibly important. I have very much solicited input from my colleagues on the other side of the aisle, including adopting some of the amendments today. I am incredibly disappointed that we're not at least going to move this forward. This is something that cannot wait, and I guess it's going to be forced to wait. I get mixed messages. I say, we got to take this step by step. But if we took our amendment to make it apply to everyone, then we would support it. And it's like, I don't buy that. And it's incredibly frustrating because this is really important legislation and we need to protect kids. Harvey's story is exactly the case where cameras protect kids. And there is a cornucopia of evidence that when people are monitored, they tend to act differently. Not everyone, obviously, but they tend to act differently. This should not be the end of the discussion. This is so important. It's not just for my kids and all these kids, but the idea that so many abusers get away with abuse because there is no evidence. It's really hard to get evidence. That's our criminal system working properly, but without video footage, it's just frankly something that doesn't happen. I know we're way over time. Thank you for being brief. The clerk will take the roll.
Katitha Watoon?
No.
West?
Aye.
Hansen?
Heartbreakingly no.
Nelson?
Aye.
Altendorf?
Yes.
Coulter?
No.
Hicks? Lee?
No.
McDonald?
Aye.
Nadeau?
Aye.
Olson?
Yes.
Perez Vega?
No.
Sensor Mura?
No.
Zalesnikar?
Aye.
There being 7 ayes and 6 nays, the motion does not prevail and the bill does not move on. Members, it is adjourned.